offering my most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, I welcome you to this week's episode of the Gita series, A Triune Pilgrimage. This is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, and as always, I have the pleasure of being seated in the studio, which was graced by Swami's presence over 13, 14 years ago, and it's my pleasure to sit here week after week and connect with all of you, and more importantly, use this opportunity to learn, share, and discuss with all of you the profound and beautiful message as given in the Bhagavad Gita. We go through every verse of the Bhagavad Gita without leaving out anything, and in the process we have come as far as the third chapter, and I could say probably in the first half of the third chapter is where we are. In the course of this program, I often tend to repeat a lot of things that I've said, and I'm pretty conscious of that because the concepts are repetitive. Krishna puts them across in different ways, and we also know that the second chapter itself contained much of the wisdom the Bhagavad Gita is all about, and the third chapter and the subsequent chapters are going to be explanations or reiterations of the same points that Krishna made. And in that sense, a lot of this is repetitive, and I always said that I'm sorry, I think I might be repeating myself again. But I think this is very, very important. I see it even from the point of view of not someone who's sitting here and conveying something to you, but from the point of view as a co-spiritual aspirant, a co-pilgrim in this path, how important it is to remind ourselves of these things over and over again. In fact, one of the listeners had written to me saying how these messages are so important that in every small aspect of life, that she has observed herself being more conscious of what she is doing. The small errors, which otherwise would have not been so important, have now become very, very something that you look out for, you ensure that you don't do, or you correct it once it has happened inadvertently. And she was saying that, you know, that is why some of these messages have to be repeated over and over again, because we are accustomed to lead our life in a certain manner, and we are making an effort to turn it around and bring it in a direction that Swami would want us to lead it in. So I'm very grateful to that sister for writing back to me with that feedback, saying that don't worry how many ever times you repeat it, it doesn't matter, because I think it is important for all of us. Thank you, sister, for echoing my feeling about it. And I think Swami would often say this, and sometimes when in his advice to some of the spiritual aspirants, Swami would say, you do not get bored of eating. You do not get bored of eating not just once, but three times a day, and you've been doing it every time, every day of your life. And Swami would even say this to those people who say that I don't have time for spiritual sadhana. I do not have time to listen to the discourses and spiritual discussions. Swami would say that you never seem to have less time for all of these other things that you do, of feeding your body and, you know, all the knickknacks that you find time for in between your meals. You don't seem to be giving up on all of that, but the first thing you're ready to give up, or the first thing you say that, oh, 1 hour is too long, or can you give it to me in 5 minutes or 10 minutes? Can you give me the crux of the message? All of this shows that we are taking this opportunity very, very lightly. As I had the opportunity to speak to some of our Swami students a couple of days back, and I was telling them this, that when we say that Swami has the love of 1,000 mothers, a mother is always looking to remove your distress, right? If you're hungry, she wants to remove that hunger. If you're unwell, you're in discomfort, she wants to give you comfort. If you're in any kind of emotional pain, she's there at your side to try to ease your, you know, mind a bit. So when we say Swami has the love of 1,000 mothers, it means that he is giving us a joy that is not temporary. He is trying to lead us to a joy which can never be taken away from us. He is not trying to give us a peace which is going to be of giving us temporary relief. He is trying to give us peace that is infinite and unlimited and ceaseless, right? And that is why Swami is said to have the love of 1,000 mothers. So if we do not give importance to this aspect of Swami's message, what Swami is trying to lead us to, I think we're missing a very, very important opportunity that Swami is giving us. So with that prayer that Swami never allows us to forget how important this is, we could you know, we all are busy with our professional life. We all are busy with our family life. And it is rightly so, because it is part of our duty. And that's the essence of the Bhagavad Gita. Krishna says that you must perform your duty. But never should our focus be removed from this larger picture, the larger goal, because that is what gives purpose to everything that we do. And with that prayer, that Swami does not allow us to leave that focus or let go of that purpose from our life. Let's begin this week's Gita series. The last week we covered three shlokas from the third chapter, shlokas 17, 18 and 19. And we also discussed that 17 and 18 are two verses that sometimes get to be misinterpreted, and I will not go into that again. I spoke at length about it last week. The reason, of course, it stands out, and it has this, it gives the opportunity to be misinterpreted, if I could put it that way, is because till now Krishna was speaking about how action or karma is inevitable, that everyone will have to, that everyone will have to perform duties. Krishna says that how everyone has to perform duties and karma is inevitable. And everyone will have duties towards the people around them, towards the situation they are in. And even if they are not, if there are no duties to others, one will still have to perform those duties that are meant for one's own sake. Like even for the upkeep of the body, actions have to be performed. But in this particular verse, that is verse number 17, Krishna speaks of one set of people who have no obligation at all. He says, that person who is an Atmarati, Atmatripta and Atmasantushta, for such a person there is no action to be done, there is no duty to be performed. And these are three descriptions which are very close in meaning, but are very different too. Atmarati is one who draws pleasure from the self. Atmatripta is the one who feels that the self is complete by itself. One does not have to become anything, one does not have to achieve anything or attain anything. And finally, Atmasantushta is one who does not look outside his self for any form of happiness, be it small or big. In other words, such a person has absolutely nothing to gain or nothing to become. The person does not even need Chitta Shuddhi, because only a person who recognizes the self as being self-sufficient will be able to have such feelings and will be able to remain in such a state. And that jnana will come only to a person after Chitta Shuddhi has been attained. So such a person does not even have to perform karma with the objective of Chitta Shuddhi in mind. So even Chitta Shuddhi is not a inspiring goal for this person to perform actions. In the 18th verse, Krishna makes a beautiful point about such an Atmanishta, because only an Atmanishta, or someone who is absolutely firmly established in the Atma, who is referred to as an Atmanishta, can attain the state. And in the 18th verse, he says that such a person has no purpose in action as much as he has no purpose in inaction. It's a very, very beautiful point. He says an Atmanishta does not have any purpose in action as much as he does not have any purpose in inaction, which means not only does he have nothing to achieve through action, but there is no reason he will choose to give up action too, or there is nothing to achieve in inaction too. So there, he is going to be equally disposed to action and inaction, karma and akarma, right? And this is a very, very important point, because Arjuna till this point is in the name of jnana trying to give up action and go away in pursuit of knowledge, right? So Krishna is making this point very clear, that somebody who is a jnani in this manner, who is self-sufficient, will not even look at inaction as an option as much as he does not have to look at action as an option, right? And though it is not mentioned clearly in the shloka, and that is what leads to the misinterpretation, given the context and the background, it is very, very clear that Krishna is saying a person who is neutral and detached also continues to act, right? We can say this more because in the very next verse, Krishna tells Arjuna, tasmat, therefore continue to act, remaining unattached. When you act that way, you will certainly attain the ultimate. right? And these were the few verses that we went through, and I think I also had the opportunity to mention how very beautifully this entire discourse, or this entire chunk of the third chapter, is captured in one message that Swami gives, a one-liner message that Swami has given us, which goes, duty without love is deplorable, duty with love is desirable, and love without duty is divine. Where you say that duty is the karma that you have to perform, and duty without love is deplorable, is not acceptable, because it becomes ordinary karma. And if you can think of the concept of love in these statements as having devotion, or as doing your actions as an offering to God, Swami says duty without love, duty without that bhava that I'm doing it as an offering to God, such duty, such performance of duty is deplorable. Duty with love is desirable, because that is what will lead us to Chitta Shuddhi, as Swami has said. But when love is done without duty, a person who does not have anything to gain from anybody around, who is beyond the stage of a doer, so there is no duty for such a person. So the duty aspect is completely removed. There is only love, and that's why when there is love, when all actions are propelled only by love, there is no duty to define those actions. Love without duty, such a person is indeed divine. So those were the verses that we went through, 17, 18 and 19. We will proceed to the verses that we have today, the next one, which is verse number 20. As always, we'll listen to the verse in the voice of Brother Shyam. And after that, I'll give you a brief meaning of the verse, and then we'll discuss in detail about it.
Karmanaiva hi samsiddhim asthita janakadayaha loka sangrahamevapi sampashyan kartumarhasi.
King Janaka and others attain perfection through action alone. Even for the sake of enlightening the world, it is thy duty to act. So the last statement that Krishna makes in the previous verse is that by unattached action one can reach the highest. Right? That's what we saw in the previous verse. As I've mentioned already a few times, there is nothing that we can do, so to say, for ajnana or ignorance to go. The ultimate goal is only reached when knowledge is attained. As Swami would say, I am divine, so are you, I know it, and you don't. Right? So if you look at this one statement, it is very, very clear that all the difference is in knowing and not knowing. Right? It's not in doing, it's not in being, or it's not in becoming something, it's only in knowing and not knowing. Because if you look at what is the reality of being, yes, he is divine and so am I. He knows it, I don't know it. So it's all in that process of knowing. And this knowing is not like being informed, right? The other forms of knowledge that we gather and gain through the process of life. This knowing is something that will percolate into each one of our actions, choices in life as a whole, right? And that is why it is best described through the analogy of rope in the dark. As long as you don't know what it is, there is fear, there is worry, and all that shows in the physical reaction in the body. But the moment you flash a torchlight and you see what it is, the moment that knowledge that it is not a snake, it is only a rope, is gained, all the reactions vanish instantly. They don't go slowly. It's not like you slowly calm down or you slowly remove all of those reactions one by one. It instantly vanishes, right? So knowledge is something like that, which once gained, it instantly percolates into all of your actions, choices and thinking, and changes the way you approach life completely, right? But anyway, so the point is, freedom from sorrow will only come with knowledge, right? Not by action itself per se. But as we've been seeing, some actions prepare us for receiving the knowledge, and some actions tend to take us further away from the point of receiving that knowledge. And Krishna has said that even those who have attained that wisdom still continue to act, but they act in an unattached manner. So one of the ways you can do karma is how they have done their karma, right? In this particular verse, the first line is an example of what Krishna has been saying in the previous two verses. The second line of this particular verse is actually a precursor or an introduction to what Krishna is going to say. So what is the first line in this verse? Krishna says, Karmana evahi, indeed through action alone, samsiddhim astita, perfection has been gained, Janaka adayaha, by Janaka and others. So this is that first statement, and Krishna is making a reference to King Janaka and others like him. I'm sure most of our listeners are aware of who King Janaka is, but for the benefit of the few who may not be aware of this very, very brilliant character from the Bharatiya tradition, King Janaka is one of the Karma Yogis mentioned in our Puranas and in our scriptures. Of course, he is more famous for being the father or the foster father who brought up Mother Sita in the story of Ramayana, right? And it is from this relationship that actually Mother Sita gets this very, very sweet name, Janaki, the daughter of Janaka. Janaka is a very, very important character in the context of Vedanta itself. In fact, his conversations with sages like Ashtavakra and Yajnavalkya are all part of Vedantic lore. Though a king, he remained a king, right? Even after he had attained that jnana, and that is what makes him a very, very important character. Not only he continued to do his duty after attaining jnana, he also attained his duty in the process of doing his karma, and that is what Krishna is mentioning here. It is through action alone, samsiddhim astita, perfection has been gained by Janaka adayaha, by Janaka and others. Not only has he attained that perfection through action, but he has also continued to act after attaining that perfect state. But this is not because he was only a king. It is also because he is a spiritual aspirant, because all of those stories that I just mentioned, Yajnavalkya, his interaction with Ashtavakra, his interaction even with Vasishta, all of that shows what a keen spiritual aspirant he was. And even through his duties, he was constantly focused on the ultimate truth and gaining understanding of that. So though Janaka being the father of Sita is not what he is most renowned for, I think even that aspect of him being the father of Sita, who gave Mother Sita in marriage to Rama, has a very, very deep spiritual significance. I think I'll come to that in a bit. But what Janaka is famous for is that he was a jnani who attained self-knowledge through Karma Yoga, and even after attaining jnana, he continued to do his duties. But why did he continue to do his duties? If he was a jnani, why did he not renounce kingdom and kingship? The moment you attain that jnana, don't you know that the kingdom is ephemeral, this kingship and this authority and all of that is meaningless? Why didn't he give up all this and just walk away? Why? Because as Krishna said in the verse number 18, naiva tasya kritanartho, for him there is no purpose in doing action, na akritena iha kaschan, nor is there purpose in not performing action. That being the case, why would he give up any action at all? So Janaka continues to act, and that is the next part of the shloka. We'll come to that. But I'll go back to this idea of Janaka, and it is to speak very, very highly of Janaka's nature that, you know, Janaka features in one of the very, very important quotes that Swami has given us. In fact, this is a quote that Swami would give the students of his university and say that I want people to be like this. And Swami would say that, you know, you should have the head of Shankara, the heart of Buddha, and the hands of Janaka. But before that, what is the meaning of this hands of Janaka, right? Talking about his connection with Mother Sita in the Ramayana, and also, you know, there is that very, very deep significance of his relationship with Mother Sita. Apart from seeing Lord Rama as an avatar and Ramayana as the story of this avatar, there is another way of looking at the Ramayana, and I think those of you who have followed us in the Ramakatha Raswaini series that we did in the afternoon satsang will be aware of this. There is something referred to as the Adhyatma Ramayana or the spiritual Ramayana, which is supposed to speak about the spiritual undercurrent or the spiritual significance of the story of Ramayana itself. And we've spoken about it extensively, but there is this one very important part where Janaka is mentioned. The significance of the story of Ramayana goes that Rama is not seen as an avatar, but it is seen as the journey of an individual Jivatma. Right? So Rama is seen as a Jivatma, and he is actually representative of each one of us. So though the Jiva or the Jivatma is as spiritual or as divine, I should say, not spiritual, as divine as Paramatma itself, right? That's one of the famous quotations of Advaita philosophy given by Adi Shankara. He says, Jivo Brahmana Apara. The Jivatma and the Brahman are not separate in any sense. They're equally divine. So in that way, though the Jivatma is also divine, the Jiva not knowing makes the Jiva lead a life of ignorance, right? And the difference is only in knowing. Swami knows it and we don't know it, and that's what makes us different from Swami. So Rama plays the role of a Jivatma who pretends that he does not know he is divine. And that is why there are many, many places in the Ramayana where when Rama is referred to as God, Rama will say that, you know, I don't understand what you're talking about me being God. I'm after all just the son of Dasharatha, the prince of Ayodhya. So he pretends as though he does not know, but that is the most important, the part of the Adhyatma Ramayana. The Jivatma goes through life as an individual who does not know his divinity. Now, who is Mother Sita in this entire scheme of things? She is spoken of as the mind that has the knowledge that the Jivatma is divine. So the Jivatma is the soul, but Mother Sita is the mind with the knowledge that the Jivatma is the soul or Rama is God, right? So when Swami says that you are divine but you don't know it, we are like Rama without the company of Mother Sita. And it is when Mother Sita joins Rama in union of marriage, it is like the Jivatma attaining that knowledge that he is divine or she is divine, right? The individual is divine. So that is why that part of the story of Rama Sita Kalyanam is celebrated in this tradition so very joyously, because it is seen as a moment of self-realization itself. Now, who is Janaka in this whole picture? You know, in the Indian tradition, in Sanatan Dharma tradition, the father of a bride at the time of a marriage gives the bride to the bridegroom in a ceremony called Kanyadanam, right? It's literally translated as the giving in arms of his daughter to the bridegroom, right? So it's called Kanyadanam. So in the Ramayana, it is King Janaka who offers Mother Sita as in Kanyadanam to Rama, right? So in the Adhyatma Rama tradition, it is said that it is King Janaka who offers this self-knowledge to Sri Rama. And when does he offer it? He gives it after testing Rama to see whether he is eligible for that. What is the test? Rama is asked to string the bow. The Shiva Dhanush is to be strung before Rama can receive Mother Sita in marriage, right? And this stringing of the bow is spoken of as the Jivatma having mastery over one's own ego. The bow is representative of ego, and you should be able to bend the bow, string it, and use the bow to do what you're supposed to do, right? It's almost like you gaining complete control over yourself. All of what Krishna said in the second chapter of a person who gains control over himself, his body, his senses, and his mind, right? That is a prerequisite for somebody who attains jnana. So that is the test Rama has given, or the Jivatma has given. Are you in control of your ego? Are you able to string this bow and use it? Of course, Rama breaking the bow is a different, it has a different meaning altogether. We'll not go into that, and that'll distract us. So this is the whole way in which it is seen, that here is Jivatma. Rama is the Jivatma, and he receives self-knowledge. And whom does he receive it from? He receives it from Janaka. And who is Janaka? Janaka is a person who is himself seen as a karma yogi. So when Swami says in that quote, very beautiful quote, that you should have the head of Shankara, the heart of Buddha, and the hands of Janaka, one sense it means that you should be able to act like Janaka, like a karma yogi. In the other sense, it means Janaka also represents, or the hands of Janaka also represents the entity which gave self-knowledge or the opportunity to self-knowledge to another person, right? So when we say that you should have the hands of Janaka, it is also a suggestion that we should live our lives in such a manner that people who observe us also are able to learn the means to self-knowledge, right? That's a very, very important point. And that is what actually comes in the second half of this particular shloka that Krishna is speaking about. Krishna says in the next line of the same shloka, he says, Api also loka sangraham eva sampashyan. Loka sangraham means welfare of the world. Sampashyan means considering or having in view, right? Pashyan means to see. Sampashyan here means considering or having in view. Loka sangraham eva sampashyan, keeping in consideration the welfare of the world, kartum arhasi. It behooves you to act, right? So now when Krishna says loka sangraham, the welfare of the world, we had even defined duty as that, right? I am in a situation, I have to act for the people around me to benefit, or I have to act so that the situation that I am in does not deteriorate because of my inaction. That is one of the definitions of duty that we had given. That's a more direct way by which our action or inaction influences the situation. But here when Krishna says loka sangraham, it means the opportunity for the people around to also take to the right path, right? The ability to give the option of true welfare to the people. So Krishna says, at least for the sake of loka sangraham, with that idea in mind that people around will take to the right path, Krishna is telling Arjuna that if you acting can lead others also to this. So when we said the hands of Janaka means the ability of a person to give self-knowledge to another person, it's not like I'm going to be so spiritual that I can give you self-knowledge. But if I am in the process of reaching that self-knowledge, if I am wise, and if I act in a certain manner, the people around me will benefit by observing me, right? Now, how can my action lead to another's enlightenment? How is it that by observing me, they will also fall in line? I think that's what Krishna says in the next verse that we're going to go through. Because this is again a very, very important point. It is not only about a jnani, as we will see. It is important even for a responsible person in society. We'll listen to verse number 21 and then we'll discuss about this particular point that Krishna is making.
Yadyadacharate shreshthah tattaddevetaro janah sayat pramanam kurute lokastadanu vartate.
Whatsoever a great man does, other commoners do the same. Whatever standard he sets, the world follows that. So this is verse number 21, where Krishna explains that in what way Arjuna acting is going to be useful to the world itself. Shreshtaha, you say, Shreshtaha is a great one, a noble person. Yad yad acharati, whatever they do, whatever a Shreshta does, tat tat eva, that alone, itaro janaha, the other people follow. Sir, that person, yat pramanam kurute, whatever he sets as proper or as a standard, lokaha tat anuvartate, the world follows that. Right? A very, very beautiful verse he says, because a Shreshta, a person who's of noble nature, who's of a wise person, whatever he does in his everyday life, yadyat acharati, whatever he practices, tat tat eva itaro janaha, that is what is followed by other people. And that is why this person should be careful of whatever he says. And it's a very, Krishna says that beyond doing for self-benefit, beyond merely doing our duties towards those that are dependent on us or related to us, when a wise man acts, the world follows it. So if every person of wisdom only becomes a renunciant and who goes away to the forest, then people will think that if we want to become spiritual, then they have to give up all of this and go into the forest, right? A jnani doing that is all right. A jnani giving up everything and going away to the forest is all right, because for him there is no difference between action and inaction. But it becomes detrimental for the people who watch him and say that, okay, I should also take to inaction, right? Precisely what has happened to Arjuna. probably he has seen some sages and renunciants in his life, and he has kind of felt that that seems to be a better life to lead. Right? For the jnani, it does not make a difference. But the people who watch them, and when they want to become spiritual, if they get into this misunderstanding that to become spiritual, I have to give up all this and go into the forest, it becomes detrimental for that person, because for such a person, doing an action is very, very important. Duty is important to perform what is that niyatam kuru. Krishna said, you have to do what you're supposed to do, right? Kartavya karma. If that person does not do that, it is going to lead to, you know, him falling off the path, and that is why it is very important for that person to act. But this is not so only for the jnani, right? Krishna is saying this to Arjuna. Arjuna is not a jnani still. But nevertheless, he is a great and noble person. And Arjuna's subjects and Arjuna's the common people in the kingdom look up to him. In fact, if you look at our own lives and we look at the society we live in, we all have such role models in our life, don't we? And their duty becomes far more important because they are being observed, because they are being looked up upon, right? So their duty becomes all the more sacrosanct, because not only are they performing their duty for their own sake and for the people around who will directly benefit from it, but they are being observed, and whatever they do is going to be followed. For instance, the parents at home, the children look up to them to follow whatever they do, or the teacher in the class. In this case, even the kings of the past were like that. The subjects used to look up to the king to follow. And that is why even in the Ramayana, you know, the standard that Rama was trying to set was so high, which was not necessarily a standard that a common man had to follow. But being a king, he had to set the bar so high, right? So even if one person is not a jnani, when in certain situations, your actions become even more important because they're being observed and they're being aped. For instance, when we were all students in Swami's hostel, we, you know, we had to follow a very, very strict discipline. I think that's known. We've spoken about it many, many times, and it's understandable because Swami used to be very particular about leading a disciplined life. And, you know, most of the disciplines which were put were relevant to that stage in life that we were leading, right? Be it our age or be it being a brahmachari in that phase of being a student. So all the disciplines that we followed, waking up early in the morning, the jogging and the games and the, you know, the food that we used to eat, all of that was made to suit the, you know, that age that we were in, right? Maybe a 17, 18 year old body that was there and the mind that had to go with it, that had to be disciplined in that particular manner. But as we grow and, you know, as we graduate from the college, it's not necessary that we will be following the same discipline in our life. Yes, we have to lead a disciplined life, but we will find a new balance, right? Because that discipline was meant for that age and that phase in life. Once we start going for work, once we start getting into family life, we have to find a different set of disciplines to regulate our life. But when we were in hostel, there would always be these senior teachers who used to stay with us in the hostel, right? They were all people, most of them were Swami students who had stayed back to serve Swami, and they used to be in the hostel as our teachers. And they would actually very interestingly follow all the schedule that we were following as students. In fact, this would become all the more interesting if you look at the higher secondary school, where you would have these 8th and 9th standard students who are probably in their early teens. And we would have these teachers who are well past the age of 60, right? And they would be following the same schedule that was made for these children who are 13, 14 years old. And we could see that their bodies were not able to keep up. You know, we could see that they were getting tired fast. They used to have sleep deficit. But they would strictly follow the disciplines of the hostel as their offering to Swami. Why would they do that? It is because we were looking up to them to learn from them how to lead our lives. And they were given this most important task of setting an example for us. So even though they did not need the discipline, they certainly didn't need that discipline of a discipline that a 17-year-old or a 13-year-old had to follow. But they followed it willfully, happily, in spite of their body not keeping up sometimes. They did it because we were looking up to them and we were trying to learn from them. And in a way, that was something that Swami expected from them. So Arjuna is being told here, you may not want the kingdom. You may not want to fight for your honor. You may not even have the attitude of revenge anymore. You may have nothing to gain, but then you must act because people will see you and follow. And there's this very, very beautiful phrase that Krishna is using in that verse. He says, pramanam kurute. Whatever you set up as example or whatever you set as a reference is what is going to be followed. He uses the word pramana, and pramana is something that we've spoken about before. It is a very important word in Vedanta. Very simply defined, it is referred to as a means of knowledge. If I wish to know about something, there are different means that I use to gain that knowledge, right? The simplest is direct means. It is called pratyaksha pramana, where I see, I hear, or I investigate myself, or I use my senses to directly see what is there, right? That is what is referred to as pratyaksha pramana. Then there is a means of inference. Based on the other info that I have, the knowledge that I have myself, the knowledge that I've gathered from others, and then I make a reference. Right, that is called anumana. I'm sorry, not a reference, an inference as to what the truth must be. For instance, let's say that I've traveled from the Bangalore airport to Parthi many, many times, and I know it just takes about 2 hours, or at best 2 hours and 20 minutes. And I know that that's all it takes to travel this distance. And let's say someone starts from Bangalore airport and they give me a call and they say that we're starting and we're heading towards Parthi. And let's say they've not reached Parthi in 5 hours. My knowledge that I have earlier and the information that I have, I can clearly deduce the fact that something must have gone wrong on the way. If it has taken 5 hours for them to come, either they've had a breakdown or, you know, they've lost their way or something must have happened. I have not directly seen it. I have not been a witness to it, but I can infer that based on whatever information that I have. Right? That is what is referred to as anumana pramana, a means of knowledge, which is an inferential means of knowledge. Right? The third pramana, which is quite important, is called shabda pramana. Let us say that, I've never been to the city of Paris, but a very good friend of mine, whom I know as a person who has a very good taste and who has a taste for the fine things in life, he's been to Paris and he comes back and he tells me that, you know, Paris is a very beautiful city. Though I have not seen the place myself, I've only heard it from this friend, but I have faith in his ability to judge the place as being beautiful, then I take his word for granted. I accept his description of the place, right? This is what is referred to as shabda pramana, that I make others' knowledge my own. I have not seen it myself, but he having seen it or she having witnessed it, I am ready to accept that as my means of knowledge, right? So this becomes a very, very important way by which we understand certain things. Let's say a scientist comes and tells me the temperature in the core of the sun is a few million degrees. Now he's saying this on the basis of some of the scientific calculations that he has done, which means his anumana pramana has led to this conclusion that the core of the sun is a few million degrees. I might not do the inference myself. I might not work out the calculations myself, but I make his pramana my own. Right? And this is what we do, and this is how we actually gain knowledge. If you look at it, much of the scientific knowledge that we have, much of the general knowledge that we have, is all based on such shabda pramana, where I am ready to make someone else's pramana my own pramana. Right? Now, when it comes to moral living, how we have to lead our lives, what is right and what is wrong, or for that matter, even a spiritual lifestyle, we may or may not directly know how we must carry ourselves. Or we may know, but we may need some inspiration to follow that particular path. So at such times, we look for wise people and tend to follow their actions. Just like how we followed our teachers in the hostel. Just like how children follow parents. And just like how Arjuna wanted to know how a sthitaprajna acts so that he can follow his actions, right? So we as a society always, in the absence of a pratyaksha pramana, in the absence of our ability to arrive at our own knowledge through an anumana pramana, we are ready to look at people who are trustworthy and we are ready to make their pramana our own. Right? And so Krishna is telling Arjuna, if as a wise person you choose to live according to the scriptures, as the scriptures, as your pramana, then the people also will follow your actions. So indirectly, they're making the scriptures their own pramana, right? And that's why that usage of that word is so very important. Pramanam kurute. If you make the right things your pramana, being a person of importance, right? And nowadays in social media, you will have these fashion influencers, they call. I don't know when that term came up, where, I mean, you'll never know these people, but somehow, you know, whatever they do in the name of fashion, the rest of the world seems to be following them, right? It's something like that. So Arjuna is being told by Krishna that, you know, you are going to be a social influencer by whatever you do. And that is why you have to ensure that you are having the right pramanas in your life, because whatever is your pramana is going to become the pramana of the people who are trying to imitate you. In fact, you know, if, there is this very beautiful part in Manusmriti. Manusmriti, we all know, is a very exhaustive text which is meant to give us the right way to lead our lives, right? Of course, it's a very controversial text nevertheless, but it is supposed to be seen as an authority in dharma. And there is this very beautiful part in the Manusmriti which says that there are four sources of dharma for us to look up to and to derive what we are supposed to do and what is right and wrong and how we should lead our lives. And Manusmriti says one is Shruti or the Vedas. The second is Smriti or the Puranas like the Ramayana, Mahabharata. In fact, Bhagavad Gita is also seen as a Smriti. The third is Sadachara or Shishtachara, right? Sadachara, Shishtachara is the behavior of the wise people, and because the final one is referred to as Atmanastushti, which means one's own self-satisfaction. So these are the four things he says that you can derive your dharma from. Shruti from the Vedas, Smriti from some of these Puranas, like these stories which have been handed down to us. The third is Sadachara or Shishtachara that we have been talking about, right? That a person of great importance sets an example and people follow, because when you're not able to derive at what is right and wrong yourself, you look up to some people and you follow. The Atmanatushti of Atmanastushti. Now that is a very important point. This is not the day for that discussion. Probably sometime it will come. It is usually translated as your conscience, right? If you're not able to derive your learning from the Vedas, if you're not able to derive it from the Puranas, if you don't have anybody around to look up to for your example, you turn within and then you go by what Atmana Priya or Atmanastushti it is called, where you go by what is pleasing to your own self. Sometimes it is translated as conscience. I think it is completely wrong to say that, because Manusmriti also says that this is the order of importance or priority that you should give. That you should give least importance to this fourth aspect, which is whatever gives you inner peace or inner calm. Because it cannot be conscience, because as we're going to see, conscience is given a place much higher than even the Vedas. In fact, I think the last week or the week before that, where we spoke about the hierarchy of, you know, karma coming from the Vedas, what that means. Karma coming from the Shrutis is equivalent to saying that the karma should be born out of the conscience. So listening to the conscience, the voice of the God within, is actually listening to the Shruti. It is when Manusmriti says that deriving your morality from Shrutis, it is also equivalent to saying that derive it from your conscience. But what he says here about the self-satisfaction or the self-peace that you feel is a very flimsy is probably not the word, not a very reliable way of you finding what is right and wrong, because it is also partly based on your own nurturing and your own vasanas and all of that. But in some cases, it can be a good way of saying what is right and wrong. As I've often said this, I think on other programs, sometimes in a situation you are very restless, right? That restlessness sometimes can be an indication that you need to act. It's an indication that you need to do something to set right the scenario around you. But it's not something that is foolproof and can always be obeyed. So let's come back to the discussion that we have in hand. So the point that I was trying to make is that Manu says that one of the ways by which people in the society can and will learn dharma is from sadachara or shishtachara. That is by looking up to the people who are shishtas, who are wise people, who are people who follow noble actions and who are moral people, right? So that is why it is very, very important that even a jnani continues to act, because he is aware that he does not have any, there is no difference for him between action and inaction, but there are people who are going to look at him and going to follow whatever he has done or she has done. And for those people, it matters whether they act or not act, right? So in fact, this Arjuna himself knows this, whatever is being told by Krishna. In the second chapter, Arjuna gave the same argument, if you remember, if you were to look back. He says that if people like us start killing kith and kin for property, there's going to be chaos in society because people will follow us and generations to come will get ruined. You know, he gives that entire beautiful argument in the first chapter or in the second chapter, right, where Arjuna gives this argument because he knows that people are going to look up to him and are going to follow. So Krishna is giving the same argument here, but just telling Arjuna that what you think is dharma is a little contorted. Let's correct that. And then the rest of it is right. People are going to follow you. So here was Arjuna saying that I don't have anything to gain from this war. I don't want a kingdom. I don't want the comforts of a royal life. I'm not interested even in revenge, which was on top of his mind when he started on this battle. So let me just leave all this and go away, right? But Krishna was telling him that you must do your duty, and he has not said categorically, but I think you can infer that probably Krishna is hinting that now that you don't want any of this, now that you feel that you don't have to gain anything from this, you probably are right now in a better state of mind to perform your duty than you were before. Krishna doesn't say this so far, but I think the hint is there, right? Almost like Arjuna said that I don't have anything to gain from here. Krishna is saying, oh, very well now. That's a precise state of mind in which you can go ahead and do your action, right? But of course, the difference is Arjuna is speaking out of virakti, right? There's a word which we use to mean dispassion that comes with sorrow and dejection and irritation and whatever it is. That is what is referred to as virakti. So Arjuna is speaking out of virakti. Out of his vishada, this virakti has come. But the selflessness that Krishna is speaking of comes out of vairagya, or the dispassion that comes from wisdom. There's a difference in that, and that is what Krishna is trying to set right, because the detachment has come, but it has come out of virakti. Now Krishna is trying to give Arjuna the wisdom so that that virakti can become vairagya, and vairagya is a better state in which wise actions and good karmas can be done. We'll go to the next verse, verse number 22, because it's another very, very important verse in the Bhagavad Gita. Swami has also again quoted this verse many times. We'll listen to it. I'll give you a brief meaning, and as much as we can find time to discuss this verse, let's do that.
Name parthasti kartavyam trishu lokeshu kinchana nanavaptam avaptavyam varta eva cha karmani.
There is nothing in the three worlds, O Arjuna, that should be done by me, nor is there anything unattained that should be attained. Yet, I engage myself in action. That's verse number 22, a very popular and oft-quoted verse from the Bhagavad Gita. So it is like Krishna is saying, why to talk about Janaka who lived a few thousand years ago, or talk about some sage or jnani or karma yogi? Krishna is saying, look at me. What better example is required? So till now, Krishna explained how a jnani who is an atmarati, atmatripta, atmaneva santushta, right? He has absolutely nothing to gain from anything. Any being in the world also continues to act. This seemed like a distant example that Krishna was giving. It's like a textbook example, right? It's a theoretical example. But now Krishna is giving him a direct example. He's saying not only it is an example of a jnani, but a direct example of a jnani in action. Because what Krishna is doing is also an action. He says, Partha, O Arjuna, name asti, there is not for me kartavyam, duty, Trishulokeshu Kinchana, even in the three worlds. He says, there is no duty for me to perform, not even a bit, not even a least bit, in the three worlds, O Arjuna. And he goes on to say, na, nothing, anavaptam, unattained, avaptavyam, there is to be attained, right? Na anavaptam, avaptavyam, there is nothing that is unattained that I need to attain, is what Krishna is saying. He says, and then he goes on to say, Varta eva cha karmani, still I am engaged in action. So Krishna is giving his own example of a selfless person. There are, and if you look at it, there are two types of selflessness. One selflessness that is born out of goodness. When people give to others without bothering much of their own needs, you know, or at least they prioritize the needs of others. That's how you kind of recognize a noble person who is ready to sacrifice his own needs or her own needs and trying to put the needs of others ahead of them. That's one form of selflessness which comes out of a noble or a good demeanor. The other type of selflessness is an expression of wisdom. When one knows that the self alone is sufficient, atmanyeva santushta, there is nothing, all the happiness that I seek is only there, is all there in the self itself. In such a person, selflessness becomes an expression of that wisdom. It is not born out of goodness, but it is born out of this understanding that there is nothing to be gained. I am everything, right? It would be a silly of us to think that, oh, I wish I had my hand. I'm making an absolutely absurd statement to show you how absurd it must be from the point of view of a jnani, right? It's like me saying, oh, I wish I had my hand, or I wish I had my head was my own. You'll look at that person and say, what do you mean? Your head is your own. Your hand is your own. So for a jnani who looks at this entire world and says that everything is myself, there is nothing which is not myself, why will that person crave for anything? So such a person, that wisdom that such a person has, spontaneously expresses itself as selflessness. In fact, it can not even be called a selflessness, but for us people who are selfish, look at it and it appears as selflessness, right? So that's what Krishna says. Na asya sarva bhuteshu kaschin artha vyapashrayaha. There is nothing for that person to gain from this entire world. Then where is the question of selfishness at all? And who can be a greater example of such a person than Krishna himself? And what can be a better example of his action than what Krishna is doing at that very point in time? Because he has got nothing to gain from the war, whether Arjuna fights or does not fight, whether Arjuna and the Pandavas win or do not win, whether who is going to sit on the throne. There is nothing for Krishna to be gained. But still he is standing there, senayor ubhayor madhye, between the two armies, and he is giving this extensive discourse to Arjuna. Isn't he the best example of a jnani who continues to do karma? And that's what Krishna is saying. Look at me. What do I have to gain from you? Right? And Krishna has established himself as someone who is beyond all the needs, right? The many, many miracles that he performed all through his life. I'm sure Arjuna himself knows about Krishna being at a level which is so much more superior than the worldly level. Probably he does not look at Krishna as the Paramatma himself, but at least he has seen that the world has nothing to offer to this Krishna. And Krishna is telling him, not only in this world, Trishulokeshu, even in the three worlds, or if there are many more worlds, nothing is there for me to gain from any of this. But still, O Arjuna, I act. You know, many times when you look at it and we think, especially when we have lived or we are living a life with Swami, we create this idea that, you know, this is what Swami wants, so this is what Swami expects. It's a good reference point for us to guide our own lives and to regulate our own lives. But if you really look at it, what is it that Swami wants and what is it that Swami does not want? Is there anything in this world that Swami wants? Many, many times, even in my own shows, I say this, or in this program or in the answering booth, we say that before you act, ask yourself, what is it that Swami would want you to do? It's a very silly statement to make because there is nothing that Swami wants. But thinking that Swami might want this might actually make us do the right thing. If you look at any of the acts of God, if you take the example of Krishna coming to the rescue of Draupadi, we look at that and say that, why did Krishna come to save Draupadi? You say that Krishna came to save the honor of Draupadi. But if you look at it, if he really wanted to save the honor, why did he let the whole event happen? He could have come and stepped in at the very moment Dushasana laid his hands on Draupadi. Why let the whole thing happen and then when he is called, he comes and he saves her honor? It's a very dangerous reflection to do, because if we are not based in truths which are deeper, some of these questions might destabilize us. But the reality is, there is nothing that Swami ever wants or needs, or there's something that will make him happy. Because if you're talking of a jnani as somebody who is Atma Tripta or Atma Neva Santushta, you're talking of the Lord, the Supreme Lord. Isn't he that? There is nothing that can happen. There is nothing that you and I can do to make him happy. He is complete in himself, right? But still he acts, but still he pretends as though he becomes happy when we do certain things. He still pretends as though that he has raga and dvesha. The Lord, who is beyond likes and dislikes, pretends that he has likes and dislikes. He pretends and he says that, you know, if you do bhajans, I will be happy. If you do namasmarana, if you do nagar sankirtan, I'll be happy. He is beyond all of these likes and dislikes, but he puts on these, just like how Krishna is acting, just like how Swami acted day in and day out. Swami did his duty more diligently than any of us who needed to do our duty, right? As Krishna has been telling, we have to perform our duty for our Chitta Shuddhi. We needed to do our duty, but we were not as diligent as Swami did his duty, who was beyond any of these needs, right? Every morning he came, 6:30 in the morning, like clockwork, giving interviews, giving darshans, coming and sitting for bhajans, unfailingly, day after day, for decades to decades, right? What can be a better example of a person who has nothing to gain from any of us, but still kept doing his duty? I think it would move us to tears seeing Swami exerting himself, right? Here we were, especially when we were students, we were 17-year-old, 18-year-old boys who had nothing to offer to Swami, literally, right? We could not give him money, we could not give him anything that would add glory or honor to him. There's absolutely nothing we could give to him, but still, whatever he did with his 100%, you know, he would do it with himself, completely involved. So there is no better example of a jnani for all of us. There is no better example for how we have to continue to do, whether we have reached the state of jnana or whether we are pursuing that jnana, right? And that is why Krishna gives this. That is why this is a very, very important shloka in the Bhagavad Gita. In the very introduction, I told you how the Bhagavad Gita is a work which is a smriti as well as a shruti. It is also a divine work because Krishna puts himself. Krishna is giving himself as a case study to explain karma yoga, right? So that is why this verse is so very important. And for all of us, it is so very beautiful, because when Krishna is giving himself as an example, we all can look at Swami and say that, yes, we have seen a living example. We have seen a person who operates from that highest level of wisdom, how he is still enthusiastic, how he is still committed to doing, you know, day after day, doing the very same thing as a duty, even though he is beyond duty, right? So I think we should be grateful. I'll probably conclude with that. We'll continue with this because Krishna goes on to explain why he acts. And even as Krishna explains, we will also see why Swami acted and why Swami continues to do his work as an inspiration for all of us. But for that, we'll have to wait for another week. I'll continue that next week. Thank you, dear listeners, for joining me this week. I most humbly offer this effort at Swami's Lotus Feet. If you have anything to share about what was discussed, if you have anything that you disagree with, anything that you want to make a point about, feel free to write to me. You can write to listener@radiosai.org. You can write to me personally, or you can even send us your feedback through our WhatsApp number. You're welcome to share whatever thoughts that you have. In a short while from now, you'll be joined by Brother Vishu for the last segment of today, the Vahini Satsang. I'll meet you all again next week, 7:30 p.m. for the resumption of this triune pilgrimage of the Gita series. Till then, take care. Jai Sai Ram.
Listening to Radio Sai Thursday Live. Stay tuned.